Welcome to the Bill Kelly Podcast. I'm Bill Kelly. Well, the Commonwealth Games bid is going before GIC today. We're going to be joined by Terry Whitehead to get his read on what's going to be going on. Balfour House is being considered for lease to Cardis by the City of Hamilton. An op-ed says it's not a good idea. We'll explain why. And Ontario's new license plates have come under fire. The government is standing by the new plates, but say they're still going to consult with the manufacturers. The Bill Kelly Podcast starts now.
Today on the Bill Kelly Show on 900 CHML.
Yesterday we had Greg Maychuk on. Of course, he is from the Hamilton 100 organization. They're the ones that are trying to get the 2030 Commonwealth Games in Hamilton. And Greg gave us a pretty extensive outline as to what they're going to be talking about when they go before city councilors later on this morning. And he said this is actually the time where they're going to start to talk numbers and crunch numbers. And there's obviously going to be some concern about what the city is going to have to do if they want to play ball with this. Greg was quite blunt about the fact that he says if the city says no, the council says no, we're not putting any money toward this. He says the bid's dead, no matter what, no matter how much private sector money there is. So the ball obviously is going to be in the court of Hamilton City Council as they listen to this presentation. One of those councillors, Terry Whitehead, joins us on the Bill Kelly Show to give us some council perspective on this. Terry, thank you for the time. Good to have you on the show today.
Great to be with you, Bill, and your listeners.
Terry, over the years as a councillor and actually in the administrative role at City Hall for many years, this is, I guess, about the third time you've been involved in a Commonwealth bid, and then, of course, the Pan Am bid. So you're used to this process, aren't you?
Oh, well, absolutely. I had an interesting perspective because I was working for the Minister of Heritage and Tourism, and in fact, that was my file for Hamilton. And so I attended a number of meetings in Manchester and, in fact, in Cape Town, South Africa. So, yeah, I'm very close to the Commonwealth file.
All right, so you've got an outline, and you get more details on Chris today from the group as they make their presentation. They've been before you once already, but they said they're going to come back with some hard and fast numbers on this now. You know, I don't want to presuppose that you're going to, you know, delve into these numbers because you're going to, I don't quite know what they are ourselves at this point. But from what you know, what's your read on this whole proposal to bring the games back for 2030?
Well, from the high level, I believe that that Hamilton has a great shot. This is we are the original location of the Commonwealth Games for the Empire Loyalist Games, and this would be the anniversary of the Empire Loyalist Games right here in Hamilton, where it all began. So that's the high level. The lower level is ensuring that the taxpayers aren't on a hook of things that we don't need, making sure that there's some strategic legacy pieces to fall out of this proposal.
Now, as Greg Maychuk explained it, and this is how I read it, what he was telling us yesterday anyway, the amount of money that they may be seeking from the city here is about equal to the project of the capital cost that would be involved that you were going to be doing anyway over the next 15, 20 years. In other words, to build some of these facilities or to do upgrades and things of this nature. I guess what they're asking you to do, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, here, is instead of using that money, put it into the pot here with us and we'll leverage the federal and provincial money. We can get everything done for everybody. Is that how you read this?
Absolutely. So this is about like being strategic and tactical to align some of the things identified in the Commonwealth bid with things that are already on the capital budget for the City of Hamilton. And therefore, we leverage more money through this process. At the same time, we move vastly ahead some of these projects that probably wouldn't have happened in a timely fashion anyway.
I guess the latest example of that, of course, is Tim Hortons Field, the stadium for the Pan Am Games. Now, I don't want to get into the debate about location and everything else, but the fact is that we were able to leverage federal and provincial money for that project and not put the cost on Hamilton taxpayers. I guess you're looking for that same sort of scenario here, are you?
Yeah, it's about leveraging as much money on projects that we've already identified as being a need. And of course, Hamilton is really need-based in the context of our forward strategy. So if the Commonwealth bid and then some of the projects they align with capital projects we've already identified, then there's a great marriage there.
So how do you see this rolling out today? I mean, I know you haven't had a chance to talk to all your colleagues. You've had some personal business I know you've been attending to over the last little while.
I got back last night.
So, but I know you've got a pretty good read on what's happening here. And you did, of course, hear the initial presentation this group put together.
Yep.
Do they get the thumbs up today? Is council going to move forward on this? It's not yet ready to make a commitment, as I understand it, but at least there's a letter of intent, I guess, that say, yeah, we're on board with this.
Yeah, so I think there's a critical path that's been laid out. There's some counselors that ask some very, very good questions for staff as part of their direction in regards to the conversations and the negotiations with the Commonwealth Committee. And those Mike Zagarek is the lead, I believe, on those conversations. And Mike has certainly, and I've been asking Mike to give me updates. I haven't seen anything that raised any red flags to this date. So that's the good news.
Are you hearing anything from your constituents on this? Because invariably, a project like this usually gets mixed reviews.
Yeah, I think when you talk to even the worst skeptic, when they understand and appreciate this is actually more of a private sector bid. And the city's going for the ride, and we're going to try and take advantage and piggyback on this particular bid to fast-track or make the investments on, again, strategic projects that we've already identified.
Are you surprised by that, the amount of private sector investment that's involved in this project? I mean, we've had it with past bids. I mean, McMaster and some of our other partners have been there. But it just seems as if everybody seems to be jumping on board. There's a lot of money involved in this, and a lot of it is private money.
Well, there's, you know, it's how it shakes out to benefit those particular private entities. But I can tell you that there's no greater opportunity to leverage three levels of government, actually, dollars, than things like the Commonwealth Games. So if you can, the private sector get involved and get some, reap some benefit from these funds, and again, leaving legacy projects in the city of Hamilton, and legacy career opportunities and so forth, I think that's wonderful. I think it's a marriage made in heaven.
Terry, you've been on both sides of this, both as a municipal representative and, of course, as you mentioned, at the provincial level, working with in that capacity. How difficult is it to leverage that money? I mean, the feds have pretty much said whoever gets the Canadian bid, if it's Hamilton, there's invariably going to be money. The province is a different situation. They haven't made a commitment to date anyway. Do you have that discussion first of all before you sign this letter, or do you just assume that they're going to be on board?
Well, I can guarantee that city won't be signing anything unless we understand who the partners are at the table at the right time. So there's always going to be, I believe, what I call an off ramp, and that off ramp would ultimately be ensuring that all the funding partners are in play.
The other thing I was quite impressed with as I listened to Greg Maychek talking to us about this yesterday is the breadth and depth of this bid. This is not just going to be a bid where, okay, all the stuff's going to go downtown and, yeah, a little bit out at Mac. It looks as if the greater community is going to benefit from this, from Waterdown all the way over to Glenbrook, from the Bayfront all the way south through to the city limits there. It looks as if, and again, I don't want to, you know, paint this as too rosy a picture because there's going to be a lot of hard work ahead, but there could be something for just about every area of this city now.
Yeah, I think it's refreshing because, as you know, Bill, most of the stuff is lower city centric, and for good reason. But here's an opportunity now to take a particular international games and international profile and try and ensure that every geographic area of the city of Hamilton is participating. And I think it's just a wonderful concept.
Yeah, we talked about different rec centers and things of this nature that I guess ordinarily you wouldn't think would be part of the games, but there are different sporting events, different things that are going to be happening in different parts of the city if, in fact, we're successful in this. What's the mood on staff in this? I mean, you know, we've been down this road before, as I mentioned. We came second the first time we did this. I mean, it was just remarkable how far down the road we went. The other one we didn't, I don't think you even got outside the Canadian bid. So is there a feeling here, a positive feeling that maybe this is our time?
Well, I think among some, I think there are skeptics. From a staff perspective, they obviously take the, not only the direction, but sort of they read council. And in the past, after the last bid, I think for the most part, council got more and more skeptical about going after any game. And then certainly after the Aberwyn Stadium issue in the Pan Am, that created even more of a skepticism in the context of hosting games in the city of Hamilton, because that was the Pan Am was more Toronto-centric, as you know.
Yeah.
So this Commonwealth Games is going to be primarily Hamilton-specific and would certainly be a different approach to all the benefits you would reap from having that kind of attention. So I want to make it clear to the audience that this is, you know, there's a lot of skepticism in council. I want to make that clear. And there's a lot of support. So it'll be continued tested until we get to signing on the dotted line.
Interestingly enough, and this is something, as we talked to a number of people on the committee, Lou Forporti and of course P.J. McCanny and Greg Maychek over the last couple of days about this, you keep talking about legacy. And in their discussions with those agencies, with the Commonwealth agencies, they seem to say that the agency itself is talking about legacy. You know, don't just tell us you're going to build a stadium, and don't tell us that, hey, you know, you're going to get this for us and we're going to get a pool. What's going to happen after the games? They seem very, very intent on making sure that there is going to be a legacy and there is going to be some follow-up, because it hasn't always happened in the past, and a lot of cities have suffered as a result of that.
Yeah, I think my sense is this is much more of a utilitarian type of approach to games, and is really focused on people and focus on how we could advance poverty and issues in City of Hamilton and homelessness and career. Like, they're really looking at a more of a social aspect to these games as well, and that's what I find really intriguing.
There's going to be a regional aspect to this too, as I understand it. I mean, we keep talking about the benefits to Hamilton, but as the Pan Am Games, you know, had spillover events, and we were part of that, obviously, with the stadium here and the soccer matches that were here. There's a possibility here for neighboring communities to benefit from this as well.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, a rising tide raises all ships. So there's no question. You host the Commonwealth Games, an international event of that size and significance. The local communities around the city of Hamilton will definitely benefit from it.
So you feel as if this is an important next step here, that as they come back with the update and start to not necessarily make a commitment as a council from a financial standpoint, but at least to indicate that, yeah, we're here. Let's crunch some numbers and just see who's going to pay for what here.
Absolutely. I think that I know for a fact that this is a really respectful group that we're working with. A lot of good, strong background and experience in the Commonwealth Games and business, and they have a real love for the city, and that, you know, that I think that's the foundation that they build upon, and they see an opportunity for this community and quite frankly for the private sector. So they're working diligently, and I'm very intrigued with the group, and I hope all the success. I'm you know, I know it's going to be scrutinized, should be on behalf of taxpayers, but I think at the end of the day, we'll do our job, and I know they're going to do theirs.
I get the sense, though, that you're not going into this with rose-colored glasses. You're still eyes wide open. You want to see some numbers. You want to see what the net benefit is going to be.
I can tell you that I'm more of the glass half full kind of approach on the Commonwealth Games, because I've seen what it's done for the communities. But not everyone's had that experience on council, and there'll be much more skepticism. So there'll be a fair balance around that horseshoe, and that will lead to a very good and productive conversation, and hopefully a very positive decision, which I'm very optimistic about in regard to moving forward.
Councillor Terry Whitehead. Terry, thanks so much for this. The meeting is getting underway in just a couple of minutes, so I'll let you go, and we'll see just how your council colleagues handle this as well. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye. That's it. Ward 15 Councillor Terry Whitehead. Here's the deal, and I don't want to jump out, because we've heard the number of people on here, P.J. McCanny and Lou Forporti, and others that are so enthusiastic, and I've talked to other committee members that have been involved in this, Cecilia Carter-Smith and so many other great Hamiltonians that jump at the chance to be able to promote this city and do what's best for this city. And I don't disagree at all that to actually win the games and actually have the 100th anniversary Commonwealth Games here in Hamilton would be an incredible accomplishment. And I do understand, based on what we've seen from other cities that have hosted the games, there's a real opportunity here. But there's always politics involved in this. Always. And I think what scuttled Hamilton's bid a number of years ago when we went this and got the Hamilton or the Canadian end of this and went all the way down, and it was between us and one other city in India, and they got it. And we were told after the fact, not officially, of course, that politics had a lot to do with it. So that's still going to be at play. And the other element to this, too, that is still kind of lurking out there is that Calgary's kind of jumping in and trying to make a last-minute bid for the games before that. Well, if Calgary were to be awarded those games, there's no way they're going to come back to Canada for the next one. So that's out there. I'm not so sure if it's as much a factor as some people want it to be or think it might be, but it's there. And until that is eradicated and we're simply moving through, and we need a clear path here before that happens. But what City Council does today is going to be very important in bolstering the confidence, I guess, in the Hamilton bid. Obviously, we've got sentimentality on our side, being the 100th anniversary, and this is where the first one was. But that's, I don't think, from what I've talked to the committee members about, what they're hanging their hat on. They want to have a strong business case for this, and we'll see how they go with their presentation today. We'll certainly follow and track that here in CHML and bring you up to speed on what's going on through the course of the day at City Hall.
You're listening to the Bill Kelly Show podcast on 900 CHML.
One of the other controversial issues among many that council is going to be dealing with, I guess they're going to be dealing with it anyway, it's scheduled to later on today, is an agreement with the Cartus organization to at least Balfour House, the historic Balfour House, over the next 20 years. The site and building are currently owned by the Ontario Heritage Trust, but looked after and administered by the city. Not the first time the Cartus has come before City Council. A couple of years ago, of course, they were involved in looking into Ockmar's situation. There will be a staff report on this today, but our next guest is very concerned that as staff did their assessment on this proposal from Cartus, that they didn't include all the factors that probably should have been included in the possibility of going into a partnership with this organization and the city. There was an interesting op-ed piece that was published in The Spectator the other day, co-authored by Graham Crawford and Cameron Croche, about their concerns, and which I think echo a number of other people's concerns here in this community about this proposed partnership. Cameron Croche joins us on the Bill Kelly Show to talk about exactly what might happen and the ramifications of. Cameron, thank you for the time. Good to have you with us today.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Bill.
Thought-provoking piece that you and Graham put together on this that I think outlines in pretty simple terms exactly what you're concerned about.
Yeah, we're really concerned that the city's going down a road here without having done their homework. They wrote a staff report, and that staff report doesn't talk at all about some of the controversies surrounding Cartus, and doesn't talk at all about their plans for making sure that the decisions they make are about equity, diversity, and inclusion for all Hamiltonians.
Which is actually what the city says. That's what they boast about. That's what they brag about. That's what they say is part of their mantra. You don't get the feeling, I guess, from what you've written in the op-ed piece, though, Cameron, that they followed through on following those ideals.
Yeah, it's a bit of a head-scratcher, Bill. I mean, about a year ago, maybe less, they started talking about how they're going to have a EDI lens, an equity, diversity, and inclusion lens, to make sure that all city decisions are made with that in mind. Last October, the city manager came forward and made it one of the top strategic priorities for the city. When you read the report, it goes over the financial implications and legal risks, but is completely silent on this topic.
No mention at all?
None. And I think it's shocking that they didn't do that, considering how many concerns have been brought up when this was before council, as you said, in 2015,
yeah.
When Cartus came back a few months ago. Lots of folks wrote in, the public outcry was there, saying, hey, you need to take a close look at this organization and where it stands on issues of homosexuality, anti-LGBTQ rights, poverty, those kinds of things. And it seems like council is just not going to do that.
You've included in your op-ed piece here a couple of excerpts from some of their literature. And I know that when you did this in the past, not you specifically, but I mean the community did this in the past, the defense from Cartus usually was, all these things are all taken out of context, which I, on a personal level, tend to think is kind of a frivolous response to that. I mean, the words are the words, and they stand on their own, I think. And a couple of them here jump out for people that didn't see this. Said, poverty is not simply a financial issue. It's the way we understand those who are incapable of making social investments or those who may not belong to anything larger than themselves. That does not sound like an inclusive... And this, by the way, we should mention, is from a publication that Cartus is responsible for, right?
Yeah, it's essentially their talking piece, their publication called Convivium that they put out. And these articles and these quotes come right from that publication, which on their website says that they produce it. And it isn't inclusive. We're in the middle of an affordable housing crisis. Poverty is one of the major issues facing people in Canada, especially in Hamilton. And we talk about this all the time. For them to have material like this out there that they're not addressing, they're leaving out there for the public to read, sends a very strong message that they're not concerned about being inclusive. And what they're concerned about, though, is wanting a partnership, right? And that's what this seems to be about, is wanting to forge a partnership with the city of Hamilton and elevate their status, move to a heritage property that's much sought after, to set up a base of operations in Hamilton. And as a city that's been ranked recently as one of the top cities with hate-based violence, it should really be a time for City Council to be reflecting on every single decision it makes with equity, diversity, and inclusion in mind. This seems to me to be an opportunistic thing Cartus is trying to do, And for the city to not even have it mentioned in its staff report to me is a glaring oversight.
There's another. There's a number of quotes here. People can go to the webpage and see a number of them if they're so inclined. But one of the other ones that you included in this it says, homosexuals are working towards a radical redefinition of public mores regarding sexuality, marriage, and the family. Now, in light of what's happened in the last 12 months in this city, Cameron, and you're well aware of that, of course, you were very much involved in this, as a number of other people in the LGBTQ community were at Gage Park and some of the subsequent actions at City Hall over the last couple of months. You would think that there would be an awareness, if not by city staff, at least by city councilors, to say, look, let's look into this a little further.
Yes, you would think there would be, Bill, because especially of all the things that have happened, as you say, in the last 12 months in the city of Hamilton, none of these things which are new to the city of Hamilton have been going on for years here. That's a question that we should all be asking ourselves, is why, given these things that have gone on, given these kinds of words that are out there on Cardis's website, would the city of Hamilton want to partner with Cardis? And that's the question I think every Hamiltonian has to ask themselves. The city doesn't appear ready to make these kinds of decisions and choices. In fact, when I contacted staff, that's kind of the response I got, which was, we're not ready to be applying an EDI lens to these kinds of decisions. And if they're not ready, they shouldn't be making these decisions. They should be putting them off. They could also, of course, refer to the 13 advisory committees that the city has and ask for their advice, many of whom are equity-seeking groups, and I'm sure would be happy to weigh in on the subject.
But why wouldn't they not apply that lens? Why even have the lens then if they're not going to use that as a tool?
That's a great question, Bill. And I think it's because
I'm asking it rhetorically to you because you're not responsible for it, but it's quizzical that they would say, yeah, we're not ready to apply that lens. Well, when will you be ready?
Well, I'm not sure when that's going to be, but it's already taken several months. And like I said, there's many other ways for them to get this information. There's many other ways for them to get this perspective. They can reach out to their residents to ask these questions. They can look at the public outcry. They could even just ask Cardis these questions in council chambers themselves. And we'll see today if that happens. But I think it's important for councillors to take this opportunity, having seen the kinds of comments that are out there, to directly ask Cardis what they're doing to make sure that they're inclusive, what they're doing to address these issues, and if they plan to change course.
There are a couple of other things about this, and I don't want to divorce ourselves from this discussion about what these people are and what they seem to stand for. But from a technical standpoint, which is actually what the city staff report, from what you're telling me, seems to be focusing on, and nothing else, it's sort of like they're sitting down there looking at numbers and not looking up to see who they're actually dealing with. But with that in mind, you mentioned, and just what I've seen from the staff report here too, this is a very important property, Balfour House, and of course, as we mentioned off the top, it's owned by the Heritage Trust, but managed by the city, administered by the city. Why did they sole source this? I mean, why did they not put out a request for proposals and give everybody who might be interested a chance at this?
Well, that was the question asked of some councillors and others at a meeting a few months ago, asking why this wasn't put out for a request for proposal. But as I'm sure you've seen and we've noticed happens a lot, the city is open to taking unsolicited proposals and open to sole source agreements.
But Cameron, that's totally contrary to city policy.
It's completely contrary to city policy, which is one of the reasons why I think this requires some deep analysis. And to your point about the technicalities here, the Ontario Heritage Trust issued a report, which was an appendix to the staff's report, and it wasn't exactly glowing, Bill. There are a lot of major issues here with respect to heritage and restoring this building. And I don't think the Heritage Trust has a lot of confidence at this point, based on the report I read, that Cardis or anybody else is in a position to undertake those things right now and to make those kinds of changes over time. And I don't know if just on those technicalities alone, this project might not go forward, which is an important reason why you need to put a request for proposal out and get multiple bids and have a robust discussion about this, about the matter.
Well, and yeah, in the open would be kind of nice too, because from what I understand, they haven't been very forthcoming with some of the numbers. I know the Heritage did an assessment on this. The Heritage Fund did an assessment on this. And just to give a general response, I guess, Cameron, they say there's a lot of work that needs to be done. It's structural work and other things that need to be done to this property. property. Is there any guarantee that they're going to undertake those projects? Is there any indication who's going to pay for these? You know, right now we've got people say, yeah, don't worry about that. But that's not really cold. It is cold comfort, really. Why aren't we having a discussion in the open about this instead of simply what seems to be a negotiation, not even a negotiation, but a sole source proposal from one agency, when in fact it might be 5 or 6 or 10 or 20 other agencies that might be able to come forward, might be able to offer a better deal to the city?
Yeah, we're being asked to kind of hold off and suspend our disbelief until a time later on when they're deep into negotiations with Cardis already. And my response to that is, why are you going down the road with this one organization? And why is it that you're doing these sole sources over and over again? If there's nothing to hide, let's have a conversation in public. And as you pointed out, the financial part of this is not in the light of day. That is an appendix that's going to be discussed in camera. And I think the public deserves to know what's going on. As you know, with Alkmaar in 2015, a lot of that was done behind the scenes and got a lot of public outrage. And the city doesn't seem to be learning.
Well, and not just with the Cardis application at Alkmaar. I mean, ever since the city took possession of that, they've basically been trying to find somebody to partner with, and it's been a problem for them. And obviously, you know, it's sitting where it is right now, and we're still wondering what's going to happen with that property. I'd hate to see the same thing happen with Balfour House here. You know, you got one chance to get it right here, and it, with your point's well taken. Have they not learned from the past here? I mean, they seem to be breaching some of their own policies here. And simply saying, well, you know, so what? That's the way things are. You can't have that. I'm surprised that some more councillors aren't outraged by this, just on process. How many times, Cameron, and you go to an awful lot of council meetings or stream them, as most of us do, to, you know, when there are key issues like this, time and time again, you'll hear some councillors arguing about process. Why didn't you follow process? We have policies here. Well, that's what's going on right here. Sole sourcing when they're not supposed to sole source. And, of course, you know, this all of a sudden confidential negotiation that seems to be going on. And they're not even applying their own lens about equity and diversity to a project like this. I mean, I if I'm on council, and thank God I'm not, but I mean, if I were, I'd be asking these questions today.
Yeah, we're stewards. Council is stewards for these heritage properties. They may be owned by the Ontario Heritage Trust, but we're entrusted to make sure that they're upkept and those kinds of things. And like you said, this seems to be a pattern of us kind of wanting to pawning these off on private groups. These are intended and were left and bequeathed to be public buildings, to have public access, not so that they can be become the gemstone for a faith-based think tank's operations privately. That's not where we're supposed to be going here. And when you listen to the conversations when Cardis came a few months ago to council, you heard councillors saying incredible things like, well, I went by Cardis for a cup of coffee and they seem like nice people. This seems to be the kind of way that influence and decision-making is happening at council, rather than them going through a rigorous process, looking at this from as many perspectives as possible, and coming out there with a good, public, transparent decision.
Well, yeah, and therein lies the problem. In other words, is this a move by city staff, and hopefully not by council, but by city staff, to simply dump this property off and try to find a way to get somebody to take it off their hands for the next 20 years and perhaps do the renovations? How many times, and I sat on, well, it was called LACAC at the time, but it's the Heritage Committee now, where we looked after the well-being of a number of fabulous historic properties across the city over a number of years. And there, more than once we had to deal with people that own these properties or had taken over the care of those properties and simply let them become dilapidated properties because they don't do the work. And then what happens? You know, well, they walk away and the city's stuck with a bill. I'm not suggesting that's going to happen with Cardis, but I'm not suggesting that there's any information that they haven't guaranteed that that's not going to happen either. When we don't have any information, well, that's where speculation starts to become rampant.
Yeah, it's the city of Hamilton's job to ensure that these properties are protected and maintained for public use. And if the last year has been any example, we can see that sometimes those checks and balances don't work out, even when things are in our steward. That happened with the Coutts cover-up at Sewergate. I think that it's important that the city starts focusing really hard on its priorities here in terms of maintaining public assets, whether those be heritage buildings, our waterways, instead of trying to suggest, hey, maybe this other group can do this work for us, maybe we'll let this group run this building for us that's public and hope they do a good job. Seems like a lot of writing on the back of napkins and handshakes are happening here instead of rigorous analysis.
My first inclination, if this were presented to somebody on city staff, is if somebody came out like Carter's here and expressed a deep interest in this, my first reaction would be, well, maybe you should run this up the flagpole and see if there's anybody else out there instead of simply taking a sole source application, see what else is available. And I'm not suggesting at the detriment of Carter's. They may be the only ones who come forward. And if you do put a request for proposals out and you only get one applicant, well, that tells you something. But to not go through that first part of the process and simply say, yeah, we're just going to deal with you guys, just doesn't make any sense. And if the mantra of city council is to get the best possible deal for the residents of this city, financially, culturally, and otherwise, they haven't done that because they don't know that this is the best deal that's out there.
That came up at the last meeting of council, Bill, and another group, I believe Cobalt Connects, had wanted also to put an application in for this space. I could be getting the name wrong there. But there was at least one other party that wanted to come in and put an application in for this space. And council sat there, discussed it, and said, well, we don't think this other group's going to have the kinds of resources that Cardis has, so they're not even in the same league. We're just going to go ahead here and ask staff to go down the sole source road. And yeah, that was very irresponsible. There are many organizations who would probably like to have a property like that to maintain and take care of in a responsible way. Many who have a long history of experience restoring heritage properties. And this is not the case here at all. They've, as you said, gone down the sole source road and are not interested in looking at this from a broad perspective and talking to many possible bidders.
What do you expect is going to happen at the meeting today?
I don't know. There are some other reports that came about at the last minute that are being discussed today as well that may have an impact on this. I have the sense that staff are going to address these issues as best they can without an EDI framework. But in my experience, having watched these things happen a few times now, I have the unfortunate expectation that they're just going to go right ahead, status quo as planned, and allow the staff to get into an agreement with Cardis.
Where does the city draw the line here, Cameron? And again, it's a rhetorical question, but I think it's something that we need to discuss here. For them to simply say, look, I know there's some concerns by a number of different groups in this community about the reputation of this organization, but city staff seem to have simply been dismissive of that. Where do you draw that line? Can anybody apply as long as they get the numbers to do this and to make it attractive to the city without any consideration for what they might stand for?
I think that the words stand for are important there, Bill. This is about priorities. The City of Hamilton's strategic priorities, the priorities of residents of the City of Hamilton, and what we expect from our municipal leaders. It's important, as always, to strike a balance between financial and legal risks. Everyone gets that. Anyone who's ever run a business or been involved in a business knows that that balance is important. But when your priorities completely undermine focusing on folks who are vulnerable or marginalized, and when you're not looking at things from an equitable perspective, you're not considering diversity and inclusion, you're failing the residents of the City of Hamilton.
Well, this is a day where City Council is going to have to do their job, and that means vigilance, and that means looking at this in a broad perspective, and we'll see how they respond to this later on today. Cameron, thanks again for the op-ed piece, and thanks for the time today. We'll see. Ball's in their court right now. We'll see how they respond.
Yes, thanks, Bill.
Cameron Croce, of course, and check out that op-ed piece. I think it's still available. Actually, it's been reprinted by a number of other papers around the area, in Peterborough, St. Catharines, and others as well, because this is not just a Hamilton-only issue. But what's happening with Balfour House is, and that means City Council is going to have to respond accordingly.
You're listening to the Bill Kelly Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Well, if anybody thought that the return of the Ontario Legislature this week was going to accelerate the discussions and negotiations between the government and the various teachers' associations and unions, well, think again. We're no further ahead. As a matter of fact, there's some indications that we may have taken a couple of steps back in the last couple of weeks. And it's going to culminate, obviously, in a massive one-day strike, one-day walkout that's going to be happening on Friday right across the province. Joining us to talk about what's not gone on and what might be happening in the future is Harvey Bischoff, president of the Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation. Busy time for you, Harvey. Thanks for taking some time for us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Bill. I appreciate it.
Any progress at all? Any glimmer of light? I mean, since we talked a couple of weeks ago, to suggest that maybe the government wants to get serious about negotiating?
Well, not from our perspective. I mean, I'm glad to hear that a couple of the other education unions are returning to the table, but we haven't had so much as an invitation. Any outreach to suggest that there's movement from the government that would make going back to the table worthwhile? And I really have to wonder what kind of games this minister is playing, where he's clearly indicated they're willing to make some moves to get the other unions back to the table, but somehow the students that OSSTF members serve don't seem to be deserving of the same effort.
Well, and I guess you could actually question the motivation and maybe even the efficacy of some of the things that they've proposed. I know for the elementary school teachers, and I know that's not your area, but with Earl Manners, basically they're saying they'll supply more money for some of the other needs within the classroom, but the teachers pretty much have to give up their ideas about funding the pension program, which has already been funded for a number of years right now. And there is a provincial responsibility that they seem to be wanting to walk away from here. So it's not really a give and take here. It just seems as if, you know, you guys are going to have to sacrifice something if you want something for the kids. I mean, they're really pitting one against the other here.
Yeah, and to be clear, not the pension, but the benefits plan.
Yeah.
All of the unions took over the operation and the risk associated with running a benefits plan on behalf of our members from the employers in the last round of bargaining. And now you've got a government saying it's either special education or you get to keep your plan intact. We're not talking about improvements to the plan. We're talking about not having it eroded over the years. So here you have a government leveraging special education funding against a benefit plan in a way that it's absolutely unconscionable. And true, that didn't happen. You know, that's not at my table, but that's because we haven't been at a bargaining table since December the 16th.
But it's indicative, I think, though, Harvey, of the mindset that they're using in these negotiations. It really, basically, I get the undercurrent here. I mean, I've covered a number of these negotiations over the years, going back quite a few governments, and the indication that they're doing here by putting that counter offer, so to speak, against the elementary teachers, is basically saying, it's you or the students. You know, if you say no to this, then you really don't care about the students. I mean, that seems to be the mantra here.
And it is a repetition of an approach that they've already taken, going all the way back to when they first made their announcements on March the 15th of their intention to cut a quarter of Ontario's high school teachers and thousands of education workers. They said at that time they're not going to renew the funding for education workers, but we'd be able to bargain it back. And what that meant is that students began the school year without access to those education workers who support kids with special needs, who support kids who are at risk for a variety of reasons. And it was the government that chose to leverage that cut as well against the bargaining table. So they are explicitly and demonstrably willing to leverage students' educational experience, the supports that kids need, against the bargaining table. And again, it is unconscionable for a government to take that approach and to say that it's then up to us to try to bargain back supports for students.
I was talking to a commentator about this on Monday, who suggested that it looks to him as if the government's, well, the phrase he used was playing the long game here. In other words, they're just ragging the puck, figuring that eventually parents and the public in general is going to start turning against the teachers. Do you get that sense?
It's certainly hard to unpack what this government's strategy is if they ever had one from the outset. And I mean, this is a government that has botched every file they've handled, whether it's healthcare, whether it's autism, which resulted in another demonstration on Queen's Park Lawn yesterday, whether it's license plates, for heaven's sake, these guys cannot touch anything without breaking it. So whether they had a strategy from the outset, it's unclear. But if they're playing the long game, what's been demonstrated since we began taking action on December the 4th is the public's not on board with their approach. They support the things that we have on the bargaining table. They oppose the government's approach, their cuts to education, this destructive agenda they're pursuing. So the long game, to me, leads to, you know, the next election for them, where they're thrown out of office, if that's the path they want to pursue.
I'm still trying to find somebody, anybody, and I've gone online, I've talked to a number of poli-sci professors, a number of folks that have expertise in the education system. And Harvey, to this point, I have not found anybody that says, you know, this e-learning, that's the future. That's what we're going to be doing. As a matter of fact, just about all of them, the consensus seems to be this is a very ill-conceived program.
It absolutely. There's no evidence to support that this is a good idea. There's a few jurisdictions in the states that have a single mandatory e-learning credit. One I've mentioned before, it's Alabama. It ranks 49th out of 50 in American education quality. Michigan has extensive study of their mandatory e-learning program, which demonstrates that it disadvantages kids in a variety of ways. The kids are not as successful in a mandatory e-learning program as they are in face-to-face classrooms. There's a place for e-learning in certain circumstances and with certain kids, and we absolutely don't deny that. But the idea of taking the 5% of kids who voluntarily take e-learning right now, ramping that up to 100% of kids taking a mandatory 2 credits, is a recipe for disaster. It's a recipe for kids failing to accumulate credits. And when that happens, when they start to fall behind, they become at significantly greater risk for dropping out of the system. And Ontario doesn't need more dropouts. We need more kids who are prepared to move into post-secondary, more kids who are prepared to take on skilled trades apprenticeships. What we don't need is to be drumming them out of school by, providing them inadequate supports.
How far down the road do you anticipate they're going to go with this? I mean, this, as you said, right off the bat, there have been teaching positions that have been eliminated. Now they're talking about this possibility here of e-learning, which is really another process of eliminating teaching positions. In other words, if you're taking an online course, you don't need somebody in the classroom. Are we going down this road to the extent where we don't need bricks and mortar schools anymore? We just stay at home on your laptop, kids, and you can get all your credits that way. I mean, it seems bizarre here that they seem to be going down this road without any really rationalization as to why this is a better system.
And I think the reason that there's no rationalization is because, I mean, there is no good pedagogical reason for pursuing this, and the real reasons, I think, are ones they want to keep hidden. I mean, I strongly suspect that this is nothing more than the thin edge of the wedge of an attempt to privatize the publicly funded education system. They've already talked in a leaked report within the Ministry of Education about selling off parts of this system to generate revenue. Well, that's not what publicly funded education is for. It's to educate kids, to provide them with opportunities in the future, to improve Ontario's civil society, and they're talking about using it as a revenue generator. Heaven knows to whom they've promised, which cronies they've promised this program that those people could make money off of. But I think that's underlying all of this. My real fear is that's the direction they're pursuing, and that's one of the reasons that we have to be so firm in pushing back against this.
Well, and for those that think, oh, come on, you guys, you're just postulating here, there's already evidence that's happened. I mean, late Friday afternoon, and a lot of people were not aware of this, of course, they made an announcement just before a long holiday weekend that they were selling off and privatizing a good segment of the social service delivery agency here in this province, much to the chagrin of an awful lot of people that have been working very hard to try to elevate people out of poverty and to try to get them jobs. Now, apparently, some firm in the States is going to be running this. And it just shows that, anything they can do to reduce their bottom line, that's good for them. Is it better for the system? Is it better for the people that rely on the system? Who cares? That seems to be the attitude.
And this approach that they're piloting now with the social services and a sell off to a private company to administer that, it's been tried in the UK. It's been tried in Australia. They've had to pull back significantly on those programs because they were disastrous for the individuals they were meant to serve. And yet they go down this ideological path anyway that absolutely damages Ontarians in need. How they can pursue this and go down the same ideological road in education when these were absolutely not things that they promised during the election campaign is beyond me. I don't believe it's an approach that Ontarians support.
Where do you go from here? I mean, you talked with us, I guess, when this whole process started, the work to rule and a number of other initiatives, and we were wondering then just, what the next steps were going to be. We know, of course, what's going to be happening on Friday, and I'll get to that in just a couple of seconds. But how do you bring them back to the table? I mean, as you mentioned, they seem to be dividing and conquering here. They're talking to the Catholic school teachers, who, by the way, are still very frustrated by their negotiations, and they're now considering a series of one-day strikes. So I don't know that they're very confident that they're going to find any sort of common ground here, which is really just putting you all on the same side once again, where the government's simply saying, this is our rhetoric, this is our bottom line, and they're not talking anymore.
Yeah, I mean, they've tried divide and conquer, and I think it's been entirely unsuccessful. They've tried to divide the, you know, rank and file union membership from the leadership. That hasn't worked. They've tried to divide parents from educators. That hasn't worked. And I've never been more confident that they aren't going to divide the education affiliates, the education unions, from one another. I have a great deal of confidence working with my colleagues in the other unions that we will continue to hang together. We will need to clearly maintain at least the pressure on this government, continue to have the public speak out against the agenda that they're pursuing. We've been very measured and very careful about balancing that with the need to, you know, to not unnecessarily have a negative impact on students' education experience this year. But we also can't let this go unchecked, because if it does, the damage they will do to the system and to our students over the next number of years will be massive. And we know from you know what the public has been telling us that they're absolutely supportive of the positions that we've taken.
Friday, let's talk a little bit about Friday. There'll be a one-day walkout province-wide. Every publicly funded school, Catholic public schools, French language, all of them, will be taking the day as a day of protest. What's planned for that? I mean, there's more to this. I assume there's going to be demonstration at some point.
Yeah, so in a lot of places, we have locals from the various education affiliates working together to put on mass pickets and so forth. There will, we're expecting to have such a picket at Queen's Park on Friday, which will be enormous when you put together the combined membership of all of the education affiliates that work within the Toronto borders. That will be happening elsewhere as well. In Peel, they have a plan for the longest picket line potentially in history, right up here Ontario Street. It'll run for kilometers and kilometers. And so there will be a united demonstration that we oppose this government's approach. But, you know, I think it's really important to bear in mind that while you've got a minister of education who points the finger at everybody else and who claims that, you know, there's always been this sort of thing in every round of bargaining, in fact, what's going to happen on Friday will be a historic event. It has never before happened that all four education affiliates in Ontario are taking legal strike action together. And that tells you the overwhelming resistance to this government's agenda.
Of course, if there's going to be a demonstration at Queen's Park, we should mention to the public, the government's not going to be there. The Progressive Conservatives are having their policy convention down in Niagara Falls. So they're out of town on Friday. So I'm assuming there's going to be a demonstration down there, of course, where the government's actually going to be situated. But our sources tell us that there may well be a gathering of teachers in front of the Ministry of Education building on Front Street in Toronto. Can you confirm that?
I can't at the moment. I haven't seen all the detailed plans yet, so I'm not 100% sure if that will also be a picket site, I'm afraid. But I can tell you that there will be a lot of people in Niagara Falls, no doubt on Friday, but definitely on Saturday as well, greet the government down there.
If we were to send our reporters down to the ministry building, is it likely that we'll see a gaggle of teachers with picket signs?
I just can't confirm that yet. I'll make sure that I can get information to you. At this point, it is my plan to, with my affiliate counterparts, so the presidents of the other education unions, to be available in the morning together to demonstrate the unity with which we're resisting this destructive Ford education agenda.
And once that is done, of course, meaning the Friday one-day walkout, you're back to the series of rotating one-day walkouts, I guess, until you get the government's attention.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it comes down to. I mean, we will constantly reassess our actions depending on the environment we're in. And as I said, we've been very mindful of how we can go forward putting pressure on this government while you know, having the minimal impact that we can on students' education experience this year. But there's no doubt that we can't allow this agenda to go forward because it will wreak havoc on our students.
There are two possibilities here, which neither would end well. And we've seen this happen with past disputes. This is going back to the 1990s to the Harris government. One was a strike where the teachers simply went on strike. The other was when the government locked the teachers out. Is this going to come down to a staring contest between the two sides to see who blinks first?
You know, I don't really like to characterize bargaining that way. You know, I mean, obviously there, you know, there is a matter of pressure and you know, raising public attention and all of that sort of thing. Real bargaining happens when the two sides sit down at the table and not see who blinks first, but try to find creative solutions to the issues that have been raised. We're prepared to do that. We have a long history and tradition of creative problem solving at bargaining tables. And so rather than seeing it as one side or the other blinks, why don't they come and meet us at the bargaining table and we can work out proposals that actually support Ontario students, which is the opposite of what they're doing right now for all the minister's claims. But given that opportunity, you know, there's a potential for problem solving here that we're happy to engage in.
Harvey, we'll check back with you in a day or two to see just what the status is going to be in the schedule for Friday. Appreciate your time today, though.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks, Bill.
Take care. Harvey Bischoff, of course, president of the Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation. I'm sure you're aware, if you're a parent with kids in the school system right now, that Friday is a one-day shutdown for every school, public, Catholic, French, everybody else. And as we say, our sources tell us that there could be a large gathering. And we know there's going to be one at Queen's Park, but there's nobody going to be at Queen's Park, nobody from the government anyway. But there is a ministry building. The Ministry of Education building in Toronto is on Front Street in downtown Toronto. And there may well be a large demonstration there, as there will be in Niagara Falls, where the Ford government is meeting for their convention. Anyway, we'll get all the details on that, and when we get it, you'll get it.
The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on 900 CHML.
The Bill Kelly Podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. You can also listen to The Bill Kelly Show weekdays from 9 till noon on 900 CHML. I'm Bill Kelly. Thanks again for listening. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. It's free, so you never miss an episode. And make sure that you rate and review.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.